He yanked the sword clear. The scene behind him was sheer mayhem. Two more ponies were fallen, unmoving. As he watched, another skidded on the left slope and fell into an unseen crevasse. A second followed, braying all the way down. One capper chased two more back uphill. The other charged straight toward C, while Somber and Lou maneuvered to either side. She flung herself flat. It bounded over her, kicking snow. Dante was already running, sword tight at his side. Nether darkened the air. The capper ducked its head and squeezed its eyes shut, and the bolt caromed from its head, sparkling away through the anarchic snowflakes. The creature opened its eyes. It blinked as Dante's sword ripped into the top of its head. A slice of skull went flying, trailing plates and scalp. Dante glimpsed an open, pink bulb of brain. The capper planted its front feet, skidding through a semicircle that left it facing him. Distracted by its maneuver, Dante tripped. Ice gouged his chest and banged the side of his head. The capper was already upon him. Steel flashed. Ast plowed into the galloping creature, leading the way with his sword. He drove its point straight into the capper's exposed brain. Its legs went limp. It dashed into the snow, landing on Dante. The breath jerked from his lungs. He rolled, face abraded by snow. It came to a rest just past him, its back legs pinning him. He fought free. To his left, the third capper drove another pony over the ledge. A lance of shadows struck it from behind. It squealed, stiffening, then turned and sprinted up the slope. Lou watched it retreat. Dante braced his arm on his knee, fighting to catch his hitching breath. C pushed herself onto her palms and shook her head like a wet dog. Ast had been flung 10 feet from the dead capper. He got to his feet, limping. Lou glanced over his shoulder, took in the scene, and ran to Dante. "Are you all right?"
"Knocked the wind out of me," he said.
He jerked his chin at the last capper as it disappeared above the icy rim.
"How did you wound it?"
"I noticed they have a tendency to raise their tail just before they strike, and, well..."
"He tore at a new asshole," Somber said, crunching up beside them.
Dante laughed. His ribs pulsed with pain, and he clutched at them. He thought one might be cracked. He eased himself to a sitting position. The ice had scraped his cheek, meaning he had no need to cut himself. The nether answered his summons, and he sent it into his ribs. The pain dulled. Somba was already seeing to see, who sat in the snow clutching her head. Ast wiped his sword on the snow, lifted his right foot, and rolled his ankle, wincing.
"Thank you," Dante said. "You did the hard part."
He nodded to the treacherous left edge, where the three remaining ponies trotted in aimless circles, snorting and twitching.
"We need to round them up before any more are lost."
He sounded more than a little grim. Initially, Dante didn't understand why. While C appeared to have been dazed, and he and Ast had suffered moderate injuries, by and large, they'd come through it miraculously intact. But as he called to the ponies, attempting to soothe them best he could, the source of Ast's mood became clear. When the other ponies had fallen, they'd taken supplies with them. Blankets, tools, most importantly, food. Lou used the nether to fix up Ast's ankle best he could. C was blinking and scowling a lot, but she was capable of walking. They walked the three ponies down to the flat, river-like glacier, then took stock of their remaining supplies.
"I'd say there's enough to stay warm," Ast said. "Not enough to stay fed."
Dante sighed.
"Well, the cappers provided a solution to that."
"Kind of them, wasn't it?"
Lou glanced between them.
What are you talking about?
Dante shook his head. Stay here and keep watch.
Dante picked up a canvas bag of horse tack and dumped it in the snow. Ast joined him as he trudged uphill to one of the fallen ponies. Its eyes were glassy, vacant. Together they skinned it and cut away heavy strips of muscle, packing them into the bag.
What do you think? Ast said.
Dante chuckled.
He's never going to eat this.
Ast shook his head, cheeks flushed with battle. The storm will be worse in the divide. Can we cross it?
Possibly.
But if it lasts, there won't be any turning back. There's no guarantee we'll have enough food.
Dante sat back and wiped his hands in the snow.
It would be a waste to turn back.
There's no sense feeding good grain to a dying cow.
Ast slipped his blade between the pony's bowed ribs, cutting another slice of red meat and depositing it in the bag.
The Kappas are hunting in packs. Next time we won't have ponies to distract them.
Do you want to turn back?
Will you?
Show us to the pass, Dante said. We can find the way from there. Then your job is done.
Ast scrunched his face, hanging his head over the remains of the pony.
I can't leave you to cross the mountains by yourself.
Sure you can. You can literally just walk away.
And leave you to die.
You saved my life not 20 minutes ago. I don't think the gods will spit on you if you decide you've done your part.
I don't give a shit about the gods.
Ast looked up sharply, then spat, which meant, unfortunately, that it landed on the blameless pony.
I care about what's right. If you go on, I do too.
Dante dried his fingers on the inside of his cloak. I think you believe I'm forcing you to do this, Ast. But you have to understand this is your choice, and that your brain is smarter than any sense of obligation.
Surely you know the brain is worth nothing when the heart is troubled.
He grabbed the bag and stalked downhill.
Dante got up and followed him. Under Somber's care, C was able to walk without wobbling, though she didn't say much. He asked if she was all right, and she brushed him off.
They walked beside the ponies, continuing toward the peaks.
The snow followed them, channeled by the glacial valley, dancing along the ice. Traveling with two other Nethermancers was a luxury. Even with the battle and its aftermath, Dante had more than enough strength to open a hollow in the cliffs for the night, widening it to make room for the three surviving ponies. Once everyone and everything was inside, he closed the entry behind them, leaving three fist-sized holes in the thin rock to let air inside. Being out of the wind and snow and inside a safe room full of warm bodies seemed to relax everyone, ponies included.
C smiled and groaned.
Hey, who thought it was a good idea to pick a fight with 3 one-ton monsters?
I would have been happy to talk things out with them, Lou said.
Somber gazed toward the holes in the wall.
Think what you could do if you could train them for war.
Become evil, Dante said.
Or stop evildoers from getting to them first.
They fell silent, thinking this through. Wind whistled through the holes.
I can be of help, Ast said, picking up their conversation on the hill, as if it had never stopped. Wesley is not as unified as Gask, or what remains of it, but I know some of its dialects.
Somber smiled.
You know the languages of a land you've never been to.
Ast met his eyes.
Who said I've never been there?
You never said you had.
Quite an omission, given that no one goes to Wesley.
Why would you hide this?
Somber, Dante said.
The spymaster gave him a cynical look.
You want your guide in unknown lands to be a man who doesn't want you to know he knows them?
I didn't say, asked Katin, because I didn't intend to go any further than the Divide.
Somba turned on him.
Why is that? Are you not welcome in Wesley?
Ast stared him down.
I lost people there. Why do you think I left?
Enough, Dante said. If Ast knows his way around, if he can communicate with these people, it's a huge boon. We don't need to conduct an interrogation.
It's called due diligence,
Somba muttered. Dante chose to ignore that. He raised his eyebrows and asked,
So you can tell us about Wesley? It's people.
It's fractured, Ast said. It has been that way as long as anyone can remember.
The former Gascon Empire isn't exactly a homogeneous whole either.
The fact you would compare it only proves how foreign it will be to you.
Ast covered his right fist with his left palm and leaned his brow against his hands.
I can't speak for most of it. I can only tell you of those who live in the Eastern Wodons, the Spirish. They fear the ground so much they live in trees.
Lou burst out laughing.
That's true.
Ast gazed at him the way you'd look at a rat you'd hoisted up with your well water.
Should I continue?
The monk covered his mouth with his fist and cleared his throat.
By all means.
There is no point.
Ast turned his back and pulled his blankets, tugging them straight.
If we make it through, you will see it for yourselves.
Please, go on, Dante said. This is all very strange to us, that's all.
The best cure for disbelief is sight, isn't it?
He ensconced himself in his blankets and would say no more. In the morning, the cavern was thick with the stink of pony piss and dung. Dante pulled open the cave wall and snow flooded inside. It had drifted 2 feet thick against the cliff, but in the open fields, the new fall was less than 6 inches deep, and for now the skies had quit tormenting them. In the chaos of the battle, he and Somba had lost control of their dead scouts. Dante cursed himself.
Ought to have raised one of the ponies, even one of the cappers.
He could have pulled double duty as both sentry and tireless beast of burden. But it was probably for the best. Such creatures were clumsier than their living counterparts. In conditions like these, the meanderings of a dead squirrel could touch off an avalanche.
The snow proved surmountable, but it slowed them enough that Ast thought it best to tackle the divide the following day.
The peaks looked down on them, blank and forbidding. That night they found a natural cave that required only minimal modification.
Dante woke, feeling vaguely sick.
It was the air, Ast told him. Thin and hostile. It could leave you disoriented if you weren't used to it. He warned everyone to let him know if they were feeling dizzy, faint, or confused.
They trudged toward the crotch of 2 great peaks. It was the lowest pass in sight, but there was nothing like a trail,
and twice Dante had to shape switchbacks up sheer rises, as much for themselves as for the ponies. At its crest, with the wind howling like the souls of the betrayed, they stopped and stared at the sweep of glaciers, valleys, and lesser mountains, abruptly blocked by a floor of clouds.
It doesn't look all that different, Lou said.
Yet it felt like triumph.
They had crossed the Wodons. They had reached Wesley.
Chapter 16. Min grinned at the shadow as if she'd summoned it herself.
If you let it go, can you bring it back?
Blaze hesitated. The uncertainty he faced felt very foreign. He knew better than most that there were many things beyond his power. most things, to be frank, but his awareness of his limitations tended to make him feel more confident than others, not less. After so much work, such hardship, he couldn't imagine willing the wisp of nether on his finger to fly away. What if he never got it to come back? Well then, he supposed he'd find a new way to spend his life. He winked at Min, lifted his finger, and blew on it. The nether held fast. He'd no sooner got annoyed at it than it got the picture and dissipated into the coastal wind. "If I can't, I'll never forgive you." He said it deadpan, but her face creased with such worry he couldn't help laughing. By his feet, one of the tiny crabs wiggled its way into the sand. Effortlessly, he drew the nether from it. A black smudge perched on his finger. "How am I doing this?" She smiled, teasing. "Ask yourself." Figuring actions always spoke clearer than words, he sent it away and called again. But this time he was worried it might refuse him, and so it did. He tried again. It held fast to the crab, hidden in the sand. Before he could get angrier, he took a mental step back. He'd just done this, and not once, but twice. That was no accident, no fluke. How had it first come to him? When he'd accepted the prospect, scratch that, the certainty of his own death. Then he'd opened himself to that absolute end. That was when he'd stepped through the last door of summer. He conjured up the shadows again a minute later, when he'd set down his worries like a pack at the end of a long day. The power relied on something deeper than mere belief in himself, yet it seemed to help. And he found he believed. The third time took effort. The conscious opening of himself, a self that included the death of that self. But once he found that place, and breathed in and out, relaxed, the nether curled around his finger. "This is very odd, you know." He raised it inches from his nose. "When Dante did this, I'd swear it was through sheer will." "You're not Dante," Min said. "I know that," he said, but his tone was a little too hard. The nether wavered. He sighed at it. "Fickle son of a bitch." Just as it went translucent, ready to flee the scene, he sighed and accepted this was how things were going to be for him. The nether congealed, darkening to the color of a midnight cloud. "What's next?" "Now you learn to put it to use." "This might sound like an odd question at this phase, but you really believe that? That anyone can learn to use this stuff?" "It's a part of all of us, isn't it? Everyone learns to use their hands and feet. Why not the nether?" "Because it's magic. The domain of Aron's chosen." Min snorted. "That's a lie perpetuated by kings and priests. If everyone could work the nether, they'd have no call to obey their lords. So why don't you go out there and tell the people how they're being kept in bondage?" Min gazed out to sea. "That's not my place." "Really? Why isn't your place wherever the hell you want it to be?" "It wouldn't change much. If I told you that you could find peace by giving up everything you own, leaving everyone you know, and spending the next 5 years pursuing the truth, would you do it?" "I'm right here doing just that, aren't I?" "Under some very unusual circumstances." She glanced upshore, where a flock of gulls had begun to shriek at nothing. "Anyway, you might not be as skilled as your friend, but you are exceptionally speedy. Others would have to sacrifice much more. Many people would like to become great painters, but very few of them are willing to spend 10 years of their lives learning to do so." "I mean, sure, apparently I've just proven you right," Blaze said,
But it's weird to me that everyone has this potential, yet so few fulfill it.
Min laughed loudly, eyebrows widening in surprise.
Doesn't that describe all of life?
When you put it like that, it's easier to believe, and is much more depressing.
She pursed her lips. Anyway, if no one believes it is possible, no one will try, leaving only the chosen. The lie's been repeated so much, it's become the truth.
That makes more sense yet.
He rubbed his face.
I would ask you what's next on the agenda, but I think I know the answer.
Do you? Getting cocky?
Far from it. Next, I practice summer until I've got it down pat.
She grinned. Let me know when you're ready to move on.
As excited as he was to take the next step, to go from learning how to access the nether to learning how to wield it, he found himself in stock of a surprising amount of patience. Maybe it had arrived with his latest epiphany about keeping himself open, or maybe he was simply that pleased with himself. In any event, he found it no trouble to go back to his studies as if nothing had happened, crouching beside the tide pools and calling the nether to his hands. Within 4 days he had it, and he knew it. Even so, he spent 3 more days honing his technique. Putting in the time now would minimize his stumbles when he took the next step.
Ready, he told Min, once he was sure it was so.
She gave him a brief test, watched as he brought the nether oozing from the sands and swimming from the pools. She noted he couldn't draw very much of it yet, but expected his reach would expand as he learned to put the shadows to use. He smiled.
How exactly do I do that?
We'll start with something simple, keeping the nether close to its natural form.
Did you ever see Dante conjure a shadow sphere?
I was there when he did it. It was the very first thing he did.
That's because a shadow sphere, in essence, is nothing more than making the nether visible to those who can't see it.
And turning it into a shapely sphere.
She eyed him for signs of mockery, then shrugged.
That's true. It requires shaping the nether, too, though a sphere is one of its favorite forms. That's where we'll start. Show me a sphere.
Blaze brought the nether to his hands. Based on past experience, he knew that when he focused very, very hard, he was capable of summoning a glob the size of a walnut. But that would take all the strength he had. This time, he called forth enough to pack into a modest grape. It pooled in his palm like black mercury, formless. He willed it to become a ball.
It sat there, very placid about it, too. Blaze's brow tensed. He concentrated harder. After a couple minutes of fruitless mental poking and prodding, he extended his index finger and jabbed at it.
Min laughed.
Think that's dough you've got there?
I wouldn't have any idea, would I?
Nether's more like a liquid than a solid.
In that case, I'll just do the same thing I do when I want water to form a perfect sphere.
Don't get snippy, she said, with infuriating mildness. I'm trying to help.
Blaze breathed in and out and nodded.
What should I be doing instead?
First of all, it doesn't fall to earth like everything else.
What a rebel.
Second, it stays in motion when any other substance would stop.
Bearing these somewhat vague tips in mind, he tried again. But the nether was content to sit in his palm, exactly as if it were gravity's slave. And a very tired one, at that.
It's all right, Min said when he stepped back to take a breather. Don't expect this to proceed any faster than the seasons.
I'm starting to think I shouldn't have any expectations at all.
You use a lot of breathing techniques, don't you? Pay close enough attention, and you'll see the nether seems to breathe too. It's very subtle.
One of our training methods is to focus on its cycle. When it breathes out, try to make it shrink even more. When it breathes in, see if you can expand it further.
learn to give it shape through its natural movements. This made a lot of sense. Grateful to have a concrete technique to follow for once, Blaze spent days huddled over the rocks, working away on the nether, sustaining himself by munching dried kelp flakes the people harvested from farm pools on the southern curve of the beach. It took him a full day to determine the nether did indeed breathe, slowly pulsing outward, contracting, and repeating. It took much longer to figure out how to get inside it, but he did that too. As the bubble of nether breathed in, expanding, he imagined a tiny little Blaze inside it, pushing up on the ceiling with all his strength. When it contracted, the mini Blaze pulled the ceiling down instead. "That's it," Min said when he showed her. "Now every time it expands, push out. And when it contracts, don't touch it. You'll soon have a sphere. Keep pushing and expanding, one breath at a time, and you'll form a shadow sphere. Just like inflating a cow's bladder." She wrinkled her nose. "Do you spend a lot of time breathing into bladders?"
"You have to entertain the kids somehow."
Feeling pretty good about himself, he resumed practice. Within a day, he was able to shape the blob of nether in his hand into a walnut-sized sphere. But try as he might, he couldn't get it to grow any bigger. Each time it breathed out, it shrank to its original size. He spent a week tinkering with his approach. Though he didn't admit this to Min, sometimes he did visualize it as a bladder that he was inflating with his own lungs. Other times he tried moving his focus to the outside of the dark sphere and pulling from there. But nothing worked. And while persistence was a virtue, so too was recognizing when your efforts were futile. "Let me see," Min told him. "Try everything you've tried so far. Maybe it's working, but it's too minute for you to see." He ran through everything he'd attempted, even the bladder blowing. He spent several minutes on each method, and displaying them all took the better part of an hour. By the time he finished, he had a bastard of a headache. "You're right," she said. "A big fat nothing." He sighed. "I'm starting to understand why people would rather believe it's a special talent handed down by the gods. Better to believe it's not possible than to admit you don't have it in you to keep trying." Min played with the clasp of her cloak. "Would you like to leave Pocket Cove? Are my efforts that disgraceful? Just for a few days. To the south lies an island called Ko'o, home to a volcano of the same name." He rubbed his chin. "Think it's time for a live sacrifice?" "The volcano is dead, but its reefs thrive. Within them is a species of snail known as a kelivert." "The grim slug? Is this your idea of a vacation?" She glared at him until his expression promised he'd quit interrupting. "Keliverts are exceedingly rare, and the people of the pocket are partly to blame, because their shells have the unique property of helping those in their first seasons find their way." Blaze glanced up shore to the cave. "So why not skip the trip and give me one of your old ones?" "They wear out with age, and a shell seems to perform best for the person who found it." "No," he decided. "I don't want a crutch." "No one wants a crutch," she said. With such hot vehemence, Blaze knew her patience with him was thinly veiled. "But if that's what it takes to get you back on your feet, then your only choice is to swallow your pride and put it to use." He nodded once. "If you think it'll help." "Anyway," she said, softening her tone, "it's something of a rite of passage among the new people of the pocket. Didn't you want to go through the same challenges as everyone else?"
"I'd welcome it."
He jerked his thumb at the winds and clouds. "But do your people always go slug hunting when it's so cold the ocean itself is looking around for blankets?" "Prepare yourself. I'll secure permission from Ro." He didn't exactly have much to pack,
So he wound up sitting in his room, in the caves, for hours, while men conducted business in the inner tunnels. He was in the middle of an impromptu nap when she returned with the news they'd leave in 4 days. He yawned.
I thought you told me to get ready.
They've decided to come with us.
Oh, dear. Don't tell me this is becoming an event.
Didn't I warn you it's a rite of passage?
What exactly does this rite involve?
She smiled more than a little smugly. You'll have to wait and see. On the day in question, Min rousted him from bed, gave him a few minutes to take care of his business, then marched him outside. First light was breaking from the cliffs, but a boat was already waiting beyond the surf. Silhouettes moved about its deck, fighting with the rigging.
Boy, he said, once you people get moving, you don't waste time, do you?
You can sleep on the boat.
She strode across the sand.
A rowboat waited just beyond the surf. He nearly froze to death helping to push it into the tossing waves. Fighting the tide got him warmed up, at least. They rowed to the waiting vessel. Ro was there, along with 5 other women, 3 of whom Blaze recognized. Months after his arrival, he still had no idea how many people lived in Pocket Cove. The place was so quiet he could believe it was no more than a couple dozen, yet strange faces kept popping out of the woodwork. For all he knew, the tunnels secretly housed thousands. Min guided the rowboat between the boat and its outrigger. They threw ropes to the crew, who secured the lines and tossed down a rope ladder. Min scrambled up it and helped pass their few possessions up to the deck. Once she and Blaze were aboard, the crew went to work on 2 winches. The rowboat creaked, lifted clear of the waves by a loose net that had been lurking below the surface.
"Welcome to the Outcast," Ro said.
Before Blaze had a chance to answer, the crew flew into motion, hauling on ropes and trimming sails. The Outcast lurched forward and curved to the southwest. The water was so choppy, Blaze staggered to a bench and planted himself before it was able to fling him overboard. Rope handles were secured to the bench, and he hung on tight. By the time the sun cleared the eastern cliffs, the waves calmed enough for him to stand and move around. They were headed what appeared to be west-southwest. Straight ahead, a conical bluish lump sat on the edge of the ocean. He'd seen it 100 times before, though it disappeared on hazier days, but had never given it much thought. It was just one more item in the vast set of places that weren't Pocket Cove. As the ship sped through the waves, powered by a fierce eastern wind, he got a better look at Ko'o. It appeared to be little more than a volcano, steep and silent. The side of its peak appeared to have been scooped out by a hungry god, creating a slanted bowl at its top. The rubble of this event may also have been responsible for the flat plain that extended a 0.5 mile from its southern slope. Trees and greenery coated the volcano, but its upper heights remained clear, lending it the look of a dented tonsure. If he'd had to guess, he'd say Ko'o lay a solid 20 miles from Pocket Cove, yet they reached it before noon, navigating around a spur of rock and swinging into a sheltered bay with a flat, sandy beach. Rather than anchoring and rowing in, Ro guided the Outcast right up to the shore. It slid over sand and ground to a stop. Grass fringed the beach, with a forest sprouting behind it where the soil got better. Half the crew hopped out while the other half handed down sacks, some of which strained with the weight of the wood clunking inside them. Blaze pitched in. Once they finished, they waded ashore and set to digging a shallow pit in the sand. A couple women emptied logs from the sacks. Rose stacked them into an elegant triangle of kindling that mirrored the volcano. As soon as she finished, she called up the Netha and set her work ablaze. Dry smoke plumed into the air,
smelling like pepper and the incense they burned back at the tunnels. A woman with short black hair erected a grill. Another woman brought Ro a pouch. She withdrew skewered strips of red meat, which Blaze hadn't seen since coming to the cove, and laid them over the grill. The meat sizzled. Ro stood over it, flecks of nether dancing between her hands and the strips. It was all very strange to Blaze, but he'd traveled enough to know that when it involved rituals and food, strangeness was customary. Min had been gone for all this. She returned then, pants soaked, to the thighs, carrying a wriggling fish as long as her forearm. She brained it with a rock and cleaned it expertly, then flensed the meat from its ribs and set it on a hammered copper plate. Ro pulled charred meat from the grill, let it cool for a minute, then removed it from the skewers and piled it on a second plate. Crouched in the sandy grass, she ate a strip, fat greasing her lips, and passed one to each of the women, who ate their share as soon as they got it. She concluded with Blaze. "Not everything outside the pocket is to be shunned," she said. "Taste for yourself." He ate. It was venison, gamey and succulent, perfectly cooked. As much as he made fun of their repetitive fare, he actually found their stews pretty good, but this was something else. "But we don't need it." Ro kicked sand over the fire, knocking down what remained of the fancy pyre. Sparks spiraled in the wind. "The cove has all we need." She took the copper plate from Min and passed around hunks of raw fish. Each woman chewed and swallowed. The plate was held beneath Blaze's nose. The meat felt oily and smelled fishy, but Blaze wasn't one to complain. Well, he was, but not under these circumstances. He lit into his portion. Somehow, he'd gone all his life without being forced to eat raw fish. He'd seen too many worms squiggling around inside fresh catches to think it was a good idea. But it tasted simple and clean, and was firmer than he'd expected. "Do what you must do while you're away from the cove." Ro held his gaze. "But don't forget that whatever you do it for your people." Blaze nodded. "I won't forget." She began to return the plates to a sack. "We'll be back in 2 weeks."
"You're not staying?"
Ro's eyes flashed with laughter. "I've got more important things to do than help you chase snails." The others grabbed the shovels and the grill and followed her to the boat. Min stayed beside him. The women pushed the outcast free of the sand, poled it past the low breakers, then tacked against the uncooperative wind. "Will it really take 2 weeks to catch a snail?" Blaze said. "I thought they were supposed to be slow." Min gathered up the bags her people had left behind and sorted through them. Dried fish, flaked kelp, water. Not enough to last the duration, but enough so they could get their feet under them. There was also a lot of fishing line, a handful of hooks, some blankets, and four flat objects a foot and a half long, flared at one end and visibly narrow at the other. Leather straps dangled from the narrow ends. They might have been shields, except the straps were on the wrong part, and they really weren't that big. And they were made of a springy, bamboo-like wood that wouldn't protect the bearer against a yawn. "Fish feet," Min said. "I'll show you the rest of the gear later. Right now we need to find the stream. Follow it to shelter and collect firewood."
Standard operating procedure when you found yourself lost in the middle of nowhere and didn't expect to leave soon. There was no one around to steal anything, so they picked up the food, piled the rest of their stuff in the grass, and walked into the woods. Min seemed to be familiar with this part of the island, leading them to a stream, then following it volcanoward until it opened into a small clearing.
A fieldstone house sat on the side of a low hill. Blaze loosened his sword in its scabbard. Min opened the door. The single room was empty. Of people, anyway. Quite a lot of leaves, dirt, and shredded grass had been dragged inside by winds and animals. A broom stood in the corner. Blaze went to work. That left finding firewood. No great task, given they were in the middle of a deciduous forest. There was even a rusty axe inside the house, but they hardly needed it. By the time the sun was getting low, they'd carried a sizable pile of fallen branches back to the shack. As Blaze stoked the fireplace, Min went to the stream to fish with a line. She brought back 3 trout and fried them in a pan on the stove. Not quite enough for dinner, not after the work they'd put in on the day, but supplemented with their dried food, it filled their bellies. After, they sat beside the fire, digesting. Drafts snaked in through the chinks in the walls, but it was a large fire in a small space, and Blaze was able to shed his cloak. Min got up and brought one of the sacks over. She extracted its contents, the springy fish feet, 2 cane-shaped pieces of bamboo, and 2 oblong, transparent bowls. Like the fish feet, these had leather straps as well. "Time to learn your equipment." She pulled off her boots and socks, stepped on top of one of the fish feet, and strapped it on like a sandal. 1 for each foot. The closest we can come to imitating the seals. Strap them on tight, or you'll lose them in the water. This is so we can drift all day without getting tired. She handed him one of the fins. He began the laborious process of lacing it to his ankle, heel, and toes. Once he had it tight, she picked up one of the oblong bowls and fitted it around her eyes. "And this is so we can see in the water without our eyes getting stung." He accepted it when offered and placed it around his eyes. Pressure mounted. He tried to pull it away, and it held fast. To get it off, he had to slip one of his fingers between his skin and the sticky seal on the rim of the bowl. He turned the object over in his hand, tapping the tacky substance on its rim. "What the heck is that?" "The sap of a tree that grows in the Carlands." She reached for the cane-shaped bamboo stick and fit it to her mouth like a flute. "And this is so we can observe the seabed without ever coming up for air." Blaze stuck the curved end in his mouth, bit down and sealed his lips. Air whooshed out the other end of the stick. He groped for its tip and felt his warm breath flowing out. "This is quite a setup for a snail hunt," he said. "Do you guys come out here often?" "There's more in the sea than grim slugs. We harvest food, medicine, shells, dyes, pearls. We trade what we don't need." He spun around to expose his cold back to the fire. "So we've given ourselves fake fins, unscratchable eyes, and extended lungs. How do we keep warm? Last time I spent more than a minute in the ocean, I got a closer look at the nether than I wanted." "That's where I come in," she grinned. "As to the matter of the kelivert, here's what we'll be searching for." She unrolled a scroll, pinning the corners to the cabin floor with stray rocks. 2 drawings filled the page. The top one was much smaller. Its shell was pure white. Its body was a stripe of yellow. The lower drawing was larger. Its shell was black, as was its body. The shells of both the white and the black snails were spiraled like a cinnamon bun, with spiked prongs jutting radially from the shell. "What's that?" Blaze pointed to the 2 snails. "The female and the male?" "The white one is the juvenile, just a few weeks old. The older they get, the darker they get." "Aha. And we are going to be attempting to find these against a dark ocean floor?"
while generally swimming 10 to 30 feet above it.
In rough, foamy seas.
Min nodded.
The young ones aren't developed enough to be of use, but if you see one, it might mean adults are near.
And what happens if I don't find one? More exile?
That wouldn't make any sense. The trials of between are about resourcefulness, endurance, commitment. Finding Kelevert, that's just luck.
Anything else horrible I should know about them? Do they eat people?
Adults are only the size of your fist, she said, but they are venomous. We'll have spears. Try not to break the shell.
He cocked his head.
Will that disperse its power?
It won't look as pretty.
They went to bed. They spent the early morning fishing, cleaning their catch, and storing it in a pouch they concealed under a rock where animals couldn't get to it. Once the sun was well up, and the air's temperature had increased from freezing to cool, they piled their blankets above the tide line, stripped down to their small clothes, and strapped on the fish feet, breathing pipes, and goggles. The shack's many tools included thin spears with barbed tips shaped like fireplace pokers, and they'd taken four of these with them to the shore. Blaze was shivering before he dipped a toe in the water. He stood at the edge of the surf, scowling at the placid gray bay.
This really feels like suicide.
It will be cold.
She drew a small knife and poked her left biceps. A drop of blood welled beneath the point.
If it gets too cold, let me know.
Nether swooped to her hands, then leapt to Blaze. His shivers slowed, then ceased altogether. A wind was blowing over his face and arms, but he hardly felt it. He turned in a circle, trying to get a look at himself.
Whatever that is, keep doing it.
She smiled, then turned the Nether on herself. If you think you see one, signal by spinning your hand in a spiral, like their shells, and stay close. Even in the bay, the currents are stronger than they look.
She sealed the cut on her arm, and they walked toward the surf, fish feet slapping on the wet sand. A wave broke and surged to their calves. He registered the cold, but he didn't have the feeling of,
"Good gods, I'm dying! I must run south as fast and far as possible,"
that typically accompanied winter dips into a northern sea. He sloshed forward. Another wave washed past his balls. Even that wasn't so bad. Once the water ran waist deep, Min sank to her shoulders, spear in hand, and kicked out into the water. Keeping her face below the surface and the tip of her breathing tube pointed straight at the cloud-streaked skies, Blaze imitated her. His breathing soughed in his ears. Bubbles rushed past his faceplate. He was underwater, yet he was breathing. The rush of sensations, many of which were utterly frightening and wrong, forced him to stand from the water. He let the tube fall from his mouth. They'd pinched their noses shut with C-shaped copper clamps, but he could still taste salt water at the back of his throat. After a few seconds, Min surfaced and glanced back.
"Everything okay?"
"Except for the fact my body's convinced it's about to die. I'll have it convinced otherwise in a minute."
He slicked back his hair, stuck the bamboo pipe in his mouth, and lowered his face into the water. He didn't try to swim yet, just stood there breathing until the experience didn't feel quite so insane. Waves rocked past him on a rush of bubbles and sand. During the lulls, he had an incredibly clear view of the bottom, which was nothing but sandy ridges, twirling seaweed, tiny white shells, and the occasional chunk of pumice. Once he was acclimated, he gave Min the thumbs up, pushed forward, and swam. The ground sloped gently away until it was too deep to stand. Within the space of a few kicks of his fins, it suddenly dropped 10 feet deep, becoming a mixture of pale sand, black rock, and grey coral. A school of finger-length fish flashed in the sunlight,
As soon as he came within reach, they turned as one and zipped away. He laughed, bubbles tickling his ears, the noise echoing hollowly up the tube. Now that they'd hit interesting territory, Min hooked a sharp left, swimming parallel to the shore and toward the long spur of rock that sheltered the bay. The waves were even gentler than along the shore, but hidden currents tugged him in every direction. Once, water sloshed into the top of his tube. He tipped his head the wrong way and sucked down a mouthful of salt water. He thrust above the surface, sputtering and hacking.
"Water in your pipe," Min said, 15 feet away. "My lungs, mostly."
"When you feel it getting clogged, just blow out as hard as you can."
"That's scandalous, m'lady."
Her eyes rolled behind her goggles.
"Still warm enough?"
"You're a miracle worker."
They got back to swimming. The sandy floor beneath the surf had been as barren of life as the sands of a desert, but amongst the rocks and coral, creatures sprouted as abundantly as at the tide pools. Fish, crabs, anemones, starfish, snails, mussels, and all manner of bivalves. And while the fish at the pools of Pocket Cove were largely minnows and fry, those here swam in full schools, multiple species of which were longer than his hand. Eels gulped from crevices. Once, a 2-foot gray fish sped below him with a single flick of its tail, sleek as an arrow. He got so caught up watching it, he forgot to look for kelliverts. Min reminded him of the task at hand by breaking from the surface and plunging straight down. Once she reached the bottom, she picked up a small, round object, examined it, and let it fall back to the shelf of coral. As it turned out, the ocean was absolutely filled with bits of things that were white, black, or somewhere in between. Not only were they searching for something exceedingly rare, they were doing so amongst thousands of false positives. Blaze swam up and down, investigating one sighting after another, bringing any snail or shell that remotely resembled the drawings to Min for inspection. Each time she shook her head. They swam all the way to the arm of rock shielding the bay, then turned around and kicked the other direction, positioning themselves further from shore to cover new ground. Or water, as it were. They weren't too concerned about the spacing. Didn't need to cover every square inch. A kelivert could be anywhere. Min's blood-warming trick seemed to fade every hour and a half or so. As soon as Blaze began to shiver, he signaled her, and they returned to the beach so she could dose them up with another round of nether. When they came in early that afternoon, he found he was ravenous. They stoked up the scented kindling that remained in Rose's fire pit and cooked the fish they'd caught that morning. "How are you feeling?" Min asked, picking bones from the flaky white flesh.
"A bit tired and a lot salty," he said, "but all in all, in good spirits."
"Good. We've got a lot of days ahead of us. Even if we can't find you one, this won't be the end of your path." The sun was out, and they agreed they could use a few more minutes to rest their limbs and lungs, so she had him do a quick run through the seasons, and then attempt to manipulate the resulting nether. As usual, he could push the shadows outward when they expanded, but as soon as they contracted, they shrunk back to resting size. Before he could get frustrated, she strapped on her fish feet, cut her biceps, and refreshed the warmth in their skin. They returned to the waves. She swam past the surf, then stroked out to sea to continue the search. As her left arm rose from the water, diluted blood slipped down her biceps. She'd forgotten to heal it. But it probably looked worse than it was. Water always made a little blood look like a great big mess. They kicked around, scanning and diving. They'd hardly been out 5 minutes when Blaze glanced to his right, out to open ocean, and saw the shark cruising through the water in perfect silence. Chapter 17. As they passed the glaciers, ravines, crags, escarpments, talus fields and snowfields of the eastern Wodens, Dante allowed himself to daydream. He still didn't understand how Selen worked. But to date, everyone had been in universal agreement as to what it did. And that was to grant you a wish. His own wish, as he'd explained to the Hanassans, was to become immortal. He had no way to know whether this was the scope of Selen's power, but he had reason to believe so. For one thing, Kali had crossed the century mark without slowing down. Yes, he was old, but his mind and body hadn't been nearly as decrepit as they should have been. Dante had taken Kali's agelessness for granted, assuming he'd last another 30 to 50 years, and perhaps he would have. It had taken a Gascon assassin to finally put him to rest. Kali had accomplished this with no more than normal nether and mortal skills, if highly honed ones. Was it that hard to believe Selen would grant his owner much more? Even if the true immortality of the gods was out of reach, it seemed plausible, probable even, that it could grant him centuries of life. In fact, there was some, questionable, granted, historical support for the idea. A figure from the early pages of the cycle was said to have lived to be 1,080 years old. Maybe he'd pulled that trick off with a little help from the Black Star. Surely an object of such divine power could allow him to live to be at least 300 years old. With that as a minimum, infinity as a maximum, and say 500 to 1,000 years as a conservative median, what would the course of his long life allow him to see? With a millennium of uninterrupted prosperity, how grand would Narashtavik become? With Dante steady at its helm, steering it away from all pitfalls with his ancient wisdom, it seemed only a matter of time until the city turned the tables on Setevan and conquered Gask for itself. If that was what Dante wanted. Just because he could conquer the northern half of the known world didn't mean he'd want to. There were advantages to staying small. You were more nimble. He'd be more able to directly oversee all aspects of Narashtavik's course and thus ensure it fulfilled its potential greatness. Anyway, he didn't want to fall victim to hubris. A more modest expansion made sense. He could peacefully absorb Tatonin to ensure Narashtavik never wanted for grain. Given their recent history together, it would be no problem to forge a permanent alliance with the Norrin, uniting their rolling hills with the city. Then he could grow west into Gask. Through Dolendun, he thought. That would establish a nice buffer between Narashtavik and Setevan without overreaching. This would mean rearranging Narashtavik's political structure. The farmer barons of Tatornin and the chieftains of the Norrin territories deserved a voice in this hypothetical nation. A new second council ought to do it. The Council of Narashtavik could remain the governors of the city and the arbiters of Aron's will on Earth, while a separate secular council would see to the administration of the Confederacy. He liked the thought of this very much. Hell, once he carved off the slice of Gask his new empire required, Narashtavik and Setevan wouldn't even have to be enemies. Their enmity could be buried whenever King Modigan kicked the bucket. Beyond all this, however, he wondered what would become of himself. This was where his walking dreams took flight. He knew a talent like his was incredibly rare. He was the youngest ever to be named to the council, by far the youngest to be named its leader. Some of this was due to a regrettably high turnover rate during the last decade, but plenty of more experienced candidates had survived the turmoil. No, it wasn't just a matter of right place, right time. It was that he was already one of the most powerful nethermancers to walk the earth. If he stood this tall at age 26, how much higher could he climb by age 526? For that matter, what if he lived long enough to see Selen emerge again? What if Aron and Tame and Carvajal
and all the gods of the Celeset had started life as simple humans. And through skill, chance, opportunity and will, they had built themselves into beings beyond